You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 2nd, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hey, everyone.
So, guys, you know what I did this last week?
What did you did?
I built a new computer.
Built a computer?
Yeah. Oh, neat. Is it a quantum computer?
No, it's a regular
PC. Is it a robot
PC.
Computer? Oh.
I built my own. First time. I built my from scratch. You know, you order all the pieces and you put it together.
Is a computer technically a robot?
Is it a supercomputer?
It's a calculator.
It's a robot, right?
Robots have to technically be able to move, right?
I don't know. If it has a disk drive, then it can move.
What if it has only solid state drives?
It has to perambulate.
Yeah, that's true.
It has a cup holder.
You should have added a cup holder to your computer.
I need an actuator and an arm to do stuff, then it'd be a robot.
So I
needed a new recording and an editing computer. The one I was using to do the show was like 7 years old. So, although interestingly, you know, the last 10 years, you know, I think computers have they're definitely still improving, but they've plateaued a lot more. Like in the 90s, you guys remember this, right? Like if when you replace your computer, your old one's basically a doorstop. You know, by the time you're ready to replace the computer, repurposing your older ones is kind of pointless. They were so outdated. But now I still have my like two computers ago, you know, and it's fine.
Yeah, it's fine because they improved so much that they improved far beyond what you really, really need unless you're doing crazy like
exactly
3D modeling or stuff.
Rendering,
so that's, so yeah, so we're in that zone where, you could, your old computer can still do a lot of fine stuff, you know, so whatever, it's okay.
But nothing is as powerful as a home built computer because, you know, if you think about the cost of, say, buying a pre-built from one of the more popular companies, you can get a good computer from there, but, you know, you're paying quite a hefty markup. If you build your own computer, you know, you're buying state-of-the-art, well, you should be, you know, in my opinion, you should be buying the latest and greatest components, and you really are building a more powerful computer for the same money.
Yeah. So what you're saying is that I'm a total sucker because I only use laptops.
No, and laptops are fine.
If you need the portability, Apple laptops.
You can't really build your own laptop. But so, because I do editing, you know, mostly audio, some video, and plus recording the show, you know, I need a lot of power. And, you know, I just need, you know, my 7-year-old computer was getting a little crusty. So, Jay and I
waited that long.
The thing that triggered was that we really needed a new computer for the studio. And it seemed a waste to buy a computer that we would just use when we were in the studio. So I said, let me just get a new editing computer. I'm due anyway. And I'll repurpose my existing one for this to become our studio computer. So that's what I did. Then I tried to price out the pre-built. And Jay was like, no, you got to build it. So it was a bit intimidating, but he talked me into it. So the whole process was a lot easier than I thought it was going to be. You go to this website called PCPartPicker.com.
PC Part Picker.
Yep, PC Part Picker. and you pick all your parts for your PC. And then the beauty is it checks intercompatibility for all your components.
Oh, nice.
So it takes a lot of the risk out of that, you know. It makes sure that everything works with everything else. And then, so that way I could also get exactly what I want. Cause I didn't find any pre-built that was anywhere close to what like I would want. Cause it, basically
really?
Once you start, once you get to, I need a powerful editing rig, but I'm not a movie studio. You know what I mean? Like there's no podcasting rigs out there. There's nobody designs a computer for how I use it. So essentially I was in the gaming rig zone. But then, of course, if you're getting a gaming rig, they're optimizing it for gaming alone.
Video.
So, it's not – again, it's not exactly what I want. And you're paying through the nose for anything halfway decent. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. So by building it myself, I was able to get really just the pieces that I need and put it right in the sweet spot, you know, for what I needed it to do. So it was great.
You invested extra money in the sound card, for
that's
example.
Smart, yeah.
Yeah, although actually we don't need components. A sound card because our Focusrite is an external sound card. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Yep.
Beautiful.
it's beautiful. But anyway, Then Jay was going to help me do it because Jay's built a couple of computers before, but we just, you know, with the craziness going on, we couldn't get together. It was going to be like, who knows how long before we could both get together to do it. So I said, you know what, Jay, I'm just going to do it by myself. And if I get into trouble, I'll let you know. And I did it. I did the whole thing by myself. You know, it took me about four hours, huh?
What did you get? All the individual, like, motherboard and cards?
Yeah,
you
just by the case, the motherboard, a cooling system. You know, I got a couple, I got an SSD drive. You know, solid state drive.
5 1/4 floppy drive. Yeah. You're good.
I got now the newer motherboards, you can get an M.2 card, which is essentially a solid state drive that goes right on the motherboard.
That's
nice.
It's faster. It gets power from the motherboard, so you don't need to make any other connections. It looks like a little RAM chip, you know, and just plug it right into the motherboard. So I got a 1 TB M.2 drive, and I got a 2 TB SSD
terabyte
drive.
On the motherboard?
Yeah. Whoa. And that's your boot drive, basically. So that's your boot drive. Then I got a 2 TB for all my other files.
That's awesome.
Yeah, then I got, you know, a good graphics card, 32 gigs of RAM. That was really it. You know, and putting it together was not as hard as I thought it was going to be. It went smoothly. I watched a lot of videos. The instruction manuals suck.
Yeah,
they really are
suck.
Terrible. But it's
Videos are great.
The videos saved my ass.
Great assistance.
No excuse today, mm-hmm. right, Steve? Like, yeah. After your experience, you could look up on YouTube how to connect this part I bought to this other part I bought, and you very, very likely, if you're not buying something that came out last week, you're going to find someone telling you how to do it.
If you're putting anything together, you go to YouTube. That has got to be one of your yeah. main sources.
Absolutely.
Go-to sources.
You can, you know, fix your toilet on YouTube. You could do anything on YouTube. I love YouTube.
What a resource, really. It is one of the things that the internet has really paid back humanity on is like these instructional videos. I mean, I was – not to deviate too far from what Steve's talking about, but real quick, there are people that taught themselves musical instruments by getting free instructions on YouTube. It's all on there.
Yeah.
But, all right, so Steve.
Yeah.
You built your own computer. It's like cooking your own dinner, right? Now you sit down and you're using this computer that you built. You got to tell me, it is cooler, right? Like, you're looking at it like you really are on the inside of that machine. Like, you get it. You
absolutely.
Know what you did.
So, yeah, I really like the fact that, you know, after building my own computer, I feel like I'm intimately familiar with every part, every piece of that computer. It's good. I like understanding everything. And so, like, if I want to upgrade it or if I need to troubleshoot it, whatever, I know this computer inside and out now because I built it literally piece by piece.
Yep.
Hello, yeah. Steve. Would you like to play a game today?
Yeah, it's a cool experience. And I was trying to figure out why the manual's so bad. I mean, they do have all the technical information there, but they don't really walk you through it. So I think it's a few reasons. One, I think it's written by engineers for like people who know what they're talking about already.
Right.
You know what I mean? It wasn't really a user manual. But the other thing is, you think about it, like my case or my motherboard, they have to write it for any other component that they might hook to. So it's very generic, right? Like, there's no manual for assembling the exact suite of pieces that I bought. It's so the motherboard has places to connect stuff that I'm not connecting to it. And it doesn't have places to connect stuff that I might have available to connect from other things. Like, I spent a half an hour trying to figure out where to plug this one connector from the front panel onto the motherboard until I realized from watching a video that the motherboard doesn't have a connector for that. But that's like the manual doesn't tell you, like, it doesn't tell you what's not there and what you don't need to do. Right, it doesn't anticipate things that you might run into, problems that you might run into.
But Steve, you said that the website took into consideration compatibility with all your components. Wouldn't that go against that?
My case is perfectly compatible with my motherboard, but again, if a computer case wants to be able to accommodate a lot of options, my motherboard isn't necessarily using every single one of those options, and vice versa. You know what I'm saying? So, like, the audio connector has two different connectors on it for two different types of connectors that you might find on a motherboard. I had to figure out which one to use. The manual doesn't tell me because the manual doesn't know. like right, my case manual doesn't know what motherboard that I have. So that's the kind of thing where like watching a video and somebody saying, now if you don't have this or whatever, like talking you through the different options, and you do have to kind of piece it together, like what you need to do and what you don't need to do. So that multiple option thing was the only real tricky part. Like again, there was basically two places I could plug in my water cooler, and there really was no way for me to know which one to plug it into. I think it's the kind of thing where they just expect you to understand what the different options are. I think like one would be always on and the other one would be under the motherboard control, like would only turn it on when necessary. And there was no guidance as to which one of those two I should use. So I plugged it into the one that is always on and it works fine. You know, and it probably wasn't critical. I mean, I obviously like once it was a little bit anxiety provoking when I clicked the on button for the very first time, because, you know,
poof of snap. Yeah.
And critical thing is like if I screwed up the coolant, then I could melt down my processor or my motherboard. But so it booted right into the BIOS, and it contains like the temperature, like the CPU temperature. So I could see that it was really cool. Yeah. So everything was
cool,
working.
Baby.
Yeah. It was fun. It was fun. It was really, really rewarding when everything was working, you know.
Yeah, I recommend anybody out there that isn't overly intimidated by this, like just build your own. You know, take the chance. It's a lot of fun. Go to PC Parts Picker and just go for it, because you're going to end up with a yeah. Come on, Kara.
If you like to
PC
use PCs.
PC Parts Picker is funny. PC Parts Picker.
All right, Bob, get us started with a forgotten superhero of science.
Yeah, it's been a while. So this week I am going to cover Mildred Dresselhaus. That may sound familiar. 1930 to 2017. She is known as the Queen of Carbon Science. Among scientific circles, she was the first female professor emerita of physics and electrical engineering and institute professor at MIT. Amazing.
Now, Bob, they should just call her the Queen of Carbon, because that is much better than the Queen of Carbon Science. Queen of Carbon's much more catchy,
the alliteration and all. But hey, you know, scientists and all. But now that name may sound familiar, because you may remember this name from a commercial that debuted at the Super Bowl and still plays to this day. Now, it was a GE ad, and it asks what the world would be like if we treated female scientists like Millie Dresselhaus, like celebrities, as if they were celebrities. As I think, you know, I'm sure all of us agree, we should be treating scientists like celebrities in many ways. So in the commercial, it was such a fun commercial. There were girls with Millie dolls. There was a Millie Dresselhaus day. They had Millie emojis, you know, kind of like you'd have like an Einstein emoji or whatever.
They named a flavor of ice cream after her called Millie Vanilli.
Yes, which is awesome, which is awesome.
That's where that came from.
And the young girls dreaming about being scientists in the commercial. Really cool commercial. It's just a wonderful ad, and it was perfect for this segment, of course. Well, Millie really existed. She had an amazing 57-year career at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which needs no introduction. Her honors and accolades are too long to fully list here. There's just row upon row upon row of all these things. She was a director of the Office of Science at the U.S. Department of Energy, the first female president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and on, co-recipient of the Enrico Fermi Award. She even has physical theories named after her, which is maybe the ultimate, the Higgs-Dresselhaus model, which is the first fundamental model for low-dimensional thermoelectrics, which started the whole band field. Her research on carbon helped make it one of the premier elements of material science as it is today. She developed technologies based on thin graphite, which allows electronics to be embedded everywhere from cell phones to clothing. So an amazing woman. So remember Mildred Dresselhaus. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing graphite intercalation, Raman scattering, or even the photophysics of carbon nanostructures.
Did you just say Raman scattering?
Yes. Is that pronouncing?
Scatter some ramen?
Like ramen
noodles?
Yeah,
I don't know.
R-A-M-A-N.
Amazing.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Jay, tell us about NASA tracking asteroids.
NASA has released this information that a house-sized asteroid will be coming close to the Earth on October 12th of this year, 2017.
How close?
Enough to fall on Dorothy.
There's a range. I'll tell you in a second. So the asteroid is called 2012 TC4. So, Bob, guess what year they found the asteroid?
1912
BC.
Yeah. So they discovered the asteroid in 2012 at the Panoramic Survey Telescope and Rapid Response System. That's called the Pan-STARRS system in Hawaii. But back in 2012, the researchers were only able to track the asteroid for just 7 days. And I'm not even sure why that was. Interestingly, though, on its path back to the Earth, it's coming back exactly 5 years to the day. That's
cool.
Kind of odd, right? NASA estimates its size is going to be between 33 feet and 100 feet, or 10 to 30 meters wide. And the flyby path will be as close as 4,200 miles or 6,800 kilometers. The calculations have estimated the asteroid could be actually as far away, though, as 170,000 miles. That's 270,000 kilometers. So they don't really know with extreme detail its trajectory and path.
Hey, that's pretty good. I think that's pretty good detail.
Well, yeah, on astronomical scales, you're totally correct, Kara, right? Like, because we're talking about distances that are like between the Earth and the Moon, right? That's a pretty damn far distance. So there's nothing to worry about, just so everyone realizes this thing is, they're sure it's not going to hit the Earth. They've confirmed it. And in fact, this flyby is a good thing, and here is something super excited good news. Astronomers can use this flyby to test the International Asteroid Detection and Tracking Network. And I didn't know about this. Over a dozen universities are involved. Observatories and labs globally will be gathering data about how, you know, first off, we're going to be gathering data on the asteroid as it approaches, as it passes, and as it flies by. So that's why we have to have people studying it all over the Earth. And then next phase is that we have to collate our data and figure out how well that these organizations can work with each other so we can really determine with fine accuracy its trajectory, so the next time something is coming, we'll be able to do it even better. And this whole test that they're doing is also going to be examining their techniques, and they're going to vet the system's strengths and weaknesses. You know, they might need more equipment. They might need, you know, to do things quicker or communicate quicker in order to really get the data put together correctly. So overall, it's great. There's a system out there that's going to be detecting asteroids. And now when I was reading the article, I'm like, well, okay, but that's just a portion of what we need to do. So I have even more good news. Let me quick back to the asteroid and tell you a couple more interesting things, and then I'll get to the other good news. So scientists are saying that this asteroid is it's really, really ideal. It's perfect for testing our current system, and largely because we know, first, it's not going to hit the Earth, and we don't know exactly what path it's going to take. So this means that the data that we're going to collect from the global tracking will have to be combined in order for the asteroid's exact orbit to be determined. So it's kind of good that we don't know enough about it, because it'll really test the strengths and weaknesses of the system. 2012 DC-4 is the same size range as the asteroid that exploded over Russia back in 2013. And if you guys remember, 1,200 people actually got injured in that event.
That's a lot. I didn't realize it was that many.
But Kara, that's nothing
like
compared
falling
to
glass.
Well, yeah,
right?
that was Chelyabinsk. It was in Siberia. Like it was luckily, and it hit a lake. It was in like a low population area.
We could have events that happen up to a planet killer. So, this is critically important. But check this out. So NASA is not just monitoring and collecting data on asteroids. They're working on a planetary defense system against asteroids. Now, this effort is largely going to include asteroid deflection. So in June of 2017, NASA announced their first asteroid deflection mission, and it's called Double Asteroid Redirection, or DART. And the plan is to hit asteroids with enough force to change their trajectory so they don't hit the Earth. They even have their first target, and I love this.
Wow.
Check this out. Talk about the absolute perfect scenario. The asteroid that they're looking at is actually a binary asteroid, meaning it has two separate bodies that are traveling on the same trajectory. So they're going to hit one of the two bodies with their dart system to see how much they can affect its course, and then compare it to the other body and say, well, we know how much we affected it because we have two data points.
Oh, that's perfect.
That's
perfect.
And I will remind everyone listening to this show that homeopathy and chiropractic have not really done anything to help defend the Earth against asteroids, right? Last I checked. Yeah, it takes real science, real things, real math in order to do stuff like this. So, it's not just NASA. Of course, the data collection, like I said, is being done globally. So we're talking about tons of organizations. I think that NASA is organizing the whole thing. But this DART system, I mean, everything about it is perfect, right? We with enough time, we can move any asteroid, just nudge it a little bit to send it off course and not hit the Earth. So as our detection gets better, the DART system will be more effective.
Cool.
I was lucky enough just yesterday, you guys, to sit down with a woman named Dr. Carrie Nugent, who works at Caltech IPAC, and she is an asteroid scientist. She told me about three potential options. The nuclear option is quite literally the nuclear option, and that would be to explode a nuclear bomb next to it. But it's obviously the most risky because can you imagine how scary it would be to put a nuclear warhead on a rocket? Mm-hmm. You've got to hope that there's no problem with that launch. And then literally, if you don't get it off its course and it still crashes into Earth, now you have a radioactive asteroid. Like, you don't want that.
Yeah.
That's not true. Good. But she also talks about these really cool things where it's like a gravity tow situation where you send up something like a small satellite to go around it with these little boosters.
Give it a nudge.
Yeah, and actually kind of spin around it and push its pathway away. She taught me everything about asteroid orbit. I mean, fascinating, fascinating conversation. It's not going to air on my show, Talk Nerdy, for another couple of months, but definitely keep your eyes out for Carrie Nugent. And she has a great TED Talk, too.
Ooh, nice.
All right, Evan, I understand that anti-vaxxers are making a big push not to even vaccinate their pets.
Yeah, that's right, Steve. This one sort of came out of the blue, and I don't know why we really haven't talked about it much before. I don't think we've talked about the concept of anti-vaxxers and pets, but here we are. Now, the anti-vax movement probably needs no explanation to our audience, but in any case, they are people and organizations that, for various reasons, are against the vaccination of, well, people. Some believe it's a huge medical conspiracy. Some believe vaccinations cause illness. Some believe their leaders or their faith when they're instructed not to vaccinate. But regardless of the reason, these people all share one trait of being effectively science deniers when it comes to vaccinations. And up until today, I think this could be our first time talking about the anti-vaccine cults in this context of animals instead of humans. So it's sort of a new emerging front in the war versus these deniers. And according to the article that came up today in brooklynpaper.com, the reporter's name is Colin Mixon. Some Brooklynites are refusing to vaccinate their pets against virulent and potentially deadly illnesses, some of which could spread to humans, certainly, thanks to what they believe is a growing movement against life-saving inoculations. Dogs do require vaccinations, at least some. There are some core vaccinations that are considered vital to all dogs. Canine parvovirus, distemper, canine hepatitis, and rabies are all considered core vaccines by the American Animal Hospital Association's Canine Task Force.
All borders require that your dog have... It's like, I guess there are even more standards for... Yeah, kennel cough. It's the vaccine for kennel cough. So if you're going to put your dog in daycare or something, a lot of places won't even take your dog if it's not vaccinated.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know if it's considered a core vaccination. There are other vaccines for dogs, but these were listed as the core ones.
Mm. Gotcha.
So, but you're right. I have my dogs have even gone, to kennel and daycare and things. And if they're not up to date on their inoculations, they don't get in.
Yep.
There's a Lyme disease vaccine for dogs.
I know dogs Great. Get, there's a rattlesnake vaccine, isn't there? Dogs get all the good vaccines. They can take a rabies vaccine.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Well, it's
required in New York, State,
yeah.
actually.
Well, more
I think
often
it's
than not, they were, it was tested on them before people. So, you know, they may as well get some good blowback from it.
That's true.
All that experimentation.
I agree. Yeah.
Cats as well, for those who are cat lovers and own cats, they also have a regimen of vaccinations, some core vaccinations and then secondary vaccinations, that they should be having. Consult your veterinarian on an individual basis. But in any case, the increased, there's the reporter reports, the increased skepticism towards inoculating pets is likely the result of a national movement that claims vaccines can cause autism in children.
So they're afraid their dogs are going to get autism?
And dogs?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. Here's Dr. Stephanie Liff of Clinton Hills Pure Paws Veterinary Care. I had a client concerned about an autistic child who didn't want to vaccinate the dog for the same reason. She says that we've never diagnosed autism in a dog, and I don't think that you could. I did a little background on that. It seems, well, they make it seem like it's possible, but how could really we ever know? It's so beyond sort of our understanding or our ability to really detect it that it would be irresponsible of vets to do so.
That's insane.
They could say that a dog is showing the signs of something along the lines of what we understand as autism, but that's probably about as far as they can really go.
No, that's crazy. Autism is not like a disease you catch like meningitis.
Right.
Autism is a spectrum disorder. Yeah. It's based on features, and those features are central to being human. Like
social communication, social interaction.
Yeah, it's so nuts to say that a dog is autistic. I mean, we see autism in like very high order primates. Like you could say that chimpanzees have like autistic like disorders, but a dog? Oh my God, this is, I don't know. I'm getting mad.
They used an example of one of the particular breeds has a predisposition apparently for chasing its own tail around. And they think that that's, you know,
what?
Could be autism-like behavior.
No, that's just being an adorable dog.
It's silly.
It's pretty silly.
It
is. There isn't even an animal model of autism. I mean, it's so.
Yeah, so the anti-vaxxers are bringing this, their fight into the arena of veterinary medicine. And I suppose it should be expected to a certain extent. Why wouldn't they? Right? If they're not going to vaccinate their children, why would they be all for vaccinating their pets? It sort of makes sense in that regard. And you're going to have similar problems in these communities, especially in a place like Brooklyn, which is just a lot of people in a small area, a lot of animals. You tell your neighbors that you're not vaccinating, and they tell two neighbors, and they tell two neighbors, and before you know it, you've got this population of unvaccinated animals, which is not good at all.
It is amazing how a group of people can do so much harm while thinking they're the good guys.
I know. You know? Have you seen the people who, and again, this is not a commentary at all on the morality of being vegan or vegetarian, because there's a lot of really good arguments for this, but have you seen like the people who are vegan who won't feed their pets meat? It's the same kind of crazy thinking. It's like, no, but dogs need meat to live.
Yeah.
They are carnivores. Like,
what don't you
understand? You might make a moral choice. Yeah, you might make a moral choice not to eat meat, but that you can't do that to your dog. It's just crazy.
Although I just read an article, it was a study that concluded that 30%, 25 to 30% of the negative environmental effects of consuming meat is due to the meat we feed our pets.
Yeah, that's
interesting.
Yeah.
That's nutty.
So if you're a vegan for environmental reasons, don't own a pet.
Yeah, that's a good call.
That's the rule.
Or own a pet that doesn't eat meat.
Yeah, you but know, don't get a feed like a tofu parrot. To your dog.
Some of the numbers were great. It's like all the pets in the United States eat as much meat as all of France. It's like,
oh my gosh. But yeah, I remember there was an episode of like Hoarders or one of those terrible shows on A&E where this woman had all these cats and she was vegetarian, so she didn't feed them meat. And cats, of course, are carnivores. And like her cats went blind. There's some sort these amino acids they need in order to be able to see. I mean, it's horrible. Get a lizard.
Yeah.
That's right.
Feed it crickets. You'll be fine.
Carol, let me ask you a question.
Yes.
Have you ever heard of Laetril?
Is that a pill? That sounds like something that you should ask your pharmacist if it's right
for
you.
Good point.
Sounds like a medicine,
Kara.
Have you ever heard of it? Have you ever heard of it?
I don't think I have. Laetril.
Too young, Steve.
Generational gap.
That's
there.
Why I'm asking. Well, mm-hmm. This is something that.
What is it?
So Laetril was a thing in the 70s.
Cancer cure.
It was like, it was a fake cancer treatment. It is a pill.
Okay.
And it never went away completely. And it's making a comeback. And it's an interesting little history of Laetril and its parallel to the alternative medicine movement. So mm-hmm. Laetrile is basically made from almond pits. It's the substance from which it's made, amygdalin, was originally purified like in the 1800s. Goes back a long way. And in fact,
amygdala. I love it. Yeah, like almond.
Yeah. Amygdala is almond. Yeah. That's why we have an amygdala in our brain, because it's almond shaped, and amygdalin comes from almonds. Yep. So
awesome.
So yeah, freebie. What's the word there? So and they even, you know, they tested amygdalin as a medicine in the 1800s. They even tested it against cancer, and it was basically poison. You know, didn't really. It was. It's just it's a drug, and it was not very useful. It gets broken down into cyanide. You know, so that limits
the
dose a little bit. You know. So, but then, you know, some quack picked up on it in the 1950s. Dr. Ernst Krebs, not of the Krebs cycle.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah. Spelt the same way, though.
So he purified amygdalin, and what he called the amygdalin, and then he claimed it was a treatment for cancer. Did he have any double-blind placebo-controlled trials showing that it had efficacy in any cancer? No. But that didn't stop him from promoting it as an all-purpose cancer cure. And then, you know, then his son picked it up, and then other quacks like this guy John Richardson picked it up. Richardson was the first one to call it vitamin B17.
Mm. Oh God!
Right, because it's a vitamin. Vitamins, by definition, are substances, nutrients that your body can't make, and so you need to eat them. It's not a vitamin, right? It's not a nutrient. It's a drug, and it's a very toxic drug that does not have any useful medicinal dose range. So it's just. So it's which means it's just a toxin. It's just a poison.
No reason to take it. None. Zero.
Exactly. But he started spreading this notion that there was, you know, a conspiracy of like the Rockefeller family. I mean, it's really an elaborate conspiracy that he came up with. The FDA, the AMA, the National Cancer Institute, the American Cancer Society, the Rockefeller family, Big Oil, Big Pharma, were all involved in this mega conspiracy to suppress the truth of Laetrile. And to keep, because they want to make money off of keeping you sick. So that, like, they really started that meme, this whole notion that, yeah, they're hiding the cure for cancer, and they're just trying to, they want you to stay sick so they can make money off of you, and they wouldn't want you to be cured by something like this. It's all bullshit. It's all nonsense. But that really got the ball rolling on that. And at the time, so now we're talking about back in the 70s, this was before the world went crazy, when you could actually arrest people for committing health fraud and for practicing medicine without a license. And so that happened, you know, to Richardson. And then the backlash of the true believers to that, to the actions taken against Richardson, unfortunately in a big way, helped give a lot of steam to the whole alternative medicine movement. In fact, there was an organization called the Committee for Freedom of Choice in Cancer Therapy, later became the Committee for Freedom of Choice in Medicine. Again, started this whole healthcare freedom idea, the idea that people just need the freedom to be able to take whatever they choose, and that's the only way to really foil this evil conspiracy of Big Pharma. That notion is still a core notion of the alternative medicine movement. So interesting. So Laetrile really did give rise to this. So now, flash forward 40 years, and we have the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994. We have the false legitimizing of quackery and nonsense, the whole natural medicine movement, the whole healthcare freedom movement. And now, in this environment, Laetrile is making a comeback, because they've basically paved the way for selling this toxic drug as if it's a natural nutrient, vitamin B17.
This is crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. It's total nonsense. There were, even at the time, so around in the 1970s, there was about 20 studies looking at the anti-cancer activity of Laetrile, and it has none. So it's basically worthless. But of course, that's a conspiracy. Once you invoke a conspiracy, you're through the looking glass, right? There's evidence doesn't mean anything. You could believe whatever you want to believe. You could reject anything that is inconvenient. You know, facts, truth, nothing matters. All that matters is your narrative. And so what Laetrile represents is the success of that narrative, That narrative was successful partly because it's profitable. I think mostly because it's profitable. That once the supplement industry and the alternative medicine industry could make money selling toxic drugs that are untested, or to the extent that they are tested, they don't work, but with this narrative that there's a conspiracy to suppress real natural cures, they started to make millions, then billions of dollars off of that, of course, because they're selling to desperate people who are sick. And then they used that money, they used their billions to then they put that back into further lobbying and marketing, changing the laws and spreading their narrative. And that has had a profound effect on the world over the last 40 years, unfortunately, for the worse. So now we live in a world in which, you know, people actually think that you can, you know, affect the body by sticking tiny little needles in it, or that, you know, you could treat an ear infection by manipulating your back, or that you can cure cancer with almond pits, you know, but Big Pharma is trying to keep this miracle cure from you. That's the world we live in now, where that narrative has really prospered. Now, the people who should be protecting the public from, essentially, again, I don't think there's any master planner. Like, I don't think this was like somebody 40 years ago said, this is what we're going to do. You know, this is the path we're going to take to get to this point. This is all, I think, just happened organically. Just, people have ideas, like even just with Laetril, you know, some guy has one piece of the narrative and somebody else adds another piece. They try it out. Whatever works makes money. Then that flourishes, and other people, it's culture, you know, just it's cultural evolution. Other people then replicate it and tweak it. And then again, it's like an adaptive radiation of evolution, of evolving the strategy. And over 40 years, it really has been unbelievable, you know, how much
this
it has evolved.
This is the perfect thing, though, for the government to do something about. I mean, they have the power, and they don't do it.
That's where I was headed. So the academia and the government and regulators should be protecting the public from slick con artists who are making money by lying to them and then using that money to further market themselves to the public and lobby for good laws. And the government has utterly failed the public in this regard, and academia has utterly failed society in this regard. They've allowed themselves to be infiltrated by pseudoscience and nonsense. They've taken a largely shruggy, you know, blind eye approach to it. They've failed to recognize the threat that this represents to the scientific basis of healthcare and medicine. They have failed to protect the consumer. The political parties, no political party, you know, is taking this up. Even the like green anti-corporate pro-consumer, you know, party completely bought into this narrative, completely sold out the consumer and the public to con artists, to snake oil salesmen. That's where we are right now. And then if you try to point that out, you're a shill. Bingo, instantly you're a shill. That's
Isn't that
it.
Great?
You're working for Big Pharma.
Yeah.
Yeah. And people believe it. It's just really, when you really see the whole thing in context, it really is shocking and frightening.
So, but it's also a good reminder about unsinkable rubber ducks. These things, they may go down under the surface for a little while, but eventually they do resurface, and sometimes with a vengeance.
Yeah, but in this case, it actually created the safe environment for itself. You know, it actually changed the laws, changed the culture, completely denutted academia, did everything it needed to do in order to just make health fraud respectable.
Yeah, I guess, Steve, we've said this before. This is where the skeptical community steps in to educate and to get the government first to be aware of it and then to hopefully do something about it.
Yeah, we're the only ones.
Right. Who else is talking about this? Who else is calling it for what it is?
Nobody.
Clearly no one.
Even Ralph Nader, right? Ralph Nader is like the ultimate anti-corporate pro-consumer guy. I've never heard him say anything about this. That's because
to be fair, I haven't heard him say shit in decades. But,
well, but I wonder what his take,
even when he was
what
out
his
there.
Take actually would be, you know? Because...
Yeah, so Ralph Nader is big into, you know, railing against mainstream medicine. Like over 300,000 Americans are killed in hospitals every year. You know, so that is sort of the left.
Ugh.
You know, allopathic medicine is evil. We need natural, non-corporate medicine kind of approach.
I don't like where this is going.
Me neither.
So hey, if he has a different position to take, I'm happy to bring him on the show and have him articulate it.
Yeah.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, The Great Courses Plus.
You know, one of the reasons why we do this show is because we initially, you know, we all are interested in, at its core, knowledge, right? We want to learn. Mm-hmm. And The Great Courses Plus is the best resource for that because, and you must have heard this before on the show because we talk about them every week, The Great Courses Plus has over 8,000 titles on topics as broad from photography all the way to particle physics.
So this week we are recommending you watch Redefining Reality, The Intellectual Implications of Modern Science by Dr. Stephen Gimbel. Dr. Gimbel looks at a lot of amazing things. I'm just going through some of his chapter titles. Quantum mechanics, quantum field theory, transhumans, making living gods, artificial intelligence, the internet and virtual reality. If you like any of that stuff, definitely listen to this episode. I can't wait to go through it.
So guys, we want you to check out The Great Courses Plus too, just like we do all the time. Sign up now and you can watch this or any of their courses free for 1 month. But you've got to go to our special URL.
That's right. Start your free month right now. Sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics. Remember, thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to our show. Bob, you're going to tell us about robot safe crackers.
Yeah, this one was pretty cool. The recent DEF CON cybersecurity conference, I think it was in LA.
I like the name of that conference.
Right? DEF CON cybersecurity conference. I think I would like to check that out. They had a demonstration of a safe cracking robot that can crack combination lock home safes in about an hour or less, reliably, without any human intervention. Pretty slick. So this was essentially a do-it-yourself project challenged by lead Nathan Seidel's wife, who brought in the safe that did not have a combination, said, hey, crack this. And he came up with this. He got a couple of his buddies, and they put together this little robot. They now head they are the head of the Spark Fun Electronics in Boulder, Colorado. So the robot is called Spark X. And it kind of looks like an erector set that attaches to the front of the safe. It costs about $200 for parts, including a $20 Arduino board, $40 motor, and some 3D printed components. They just attach it to the front of the safe, and it does its stuff. So the crack itself is fascinating. The process, if you think about it, it should be completely impractical. Because think about it, they were working on like a common safe, like a Sentry safe, you know, 3-number combination lock. It's got 100 little numbers on the dial. So how hard is that? Very hard if you think about it. That's 3 numbers and 100 options per number. That's 100 times 100 times 100. That's 1 million number combinations that potentially could open that safe. So even if you have a robot that could do that pretty fast, I'd say, you know, 10 seconds per number, it would take you about a little under 4 months. So that's ridiculous. I mean, so even if it worked, so what? What Seidel, what he did was to shrink the solution space, which made me think of Enigma, the Enigma machine in World War II. There was just too many possibilities. But what really killed it, what made it actually practical to solve, was the fact that if you were encoding the letter E, you could not return a result of the letter E. It had to be any other letter but the letter that it was. And just that simple design decision that somebody made it solvable. Many consumer safes built, you know, made for regular people, they have a built-in 3-number tolerance because humans are humans, basically. So that means that if the number the number in your combination is, say, 35, then 35 would work, but then so would 34 and so would 36. If you're within a few digits, the safe would say, all right, that's close enough. So if you think about that 100 times 100 times 100 equals 1 million possibilities shrinks down to 33 times 33 times 33. Which brings it down to like almost 34,000 possible combinations. That's a lot smaller right there, just right there, because you only need to do every third number, right? Because it has that 3-number tolerance in it. So that's one big chunk that's washed away in terms of the time it takes and how many combinations you have to go through. Also, Seidel realized that the robot did not need to go back to zero. You know, when you try a combination and it doesn't work, so you just spin it around, you go back to zero, and then you start again. He realized you didn't need to do that for this type of safe to reset it. Cause if you choose your numbers carefully, and this is important, if you choose the number combinations carefully and the sequence of numbers that you go through, you could actually keep two of the three rotors in the lock in place, and then you could try a lot of different numbers on just the last rotor. So it's like, you know, you get the first and second combination in there, and then you could try different combinations with just the third number. And so basically that meant that you could try different sets of three number combinations really fast, because you could lock in the two numbers in a sense and just fiddle around and try different numbers for that last number. So that meant for Seidel and his crew that they could do numbers on average in 4 seconds. In 4 seconds, they could knock through a set of try a three number combination. So that saved a lot of time right there. The final one I'm going to go into is definitely more difficult to explain. So basically the third rotor for that third number had indentations on the slot. There was indentations to the left and the right. And these indentations are there to actually prevent safe cracking. Cause you know how if you kind of squeeze the dial and pull on it as you're twisting it, you could feel the pin kind of slip in. Well, these indentations actually prevented that from happening, because the indentations, as you got closer to the number, were so gradual that you couldn't sense it. But when they took the safe apart and looked at it, they realized that slot, the real slot, was a tiny of a fraction of a bit thinner than the other ones. So the computer could actually detect it in some way. So basically it could detect that last number really easily. So let me read how the website I read described this. It also turns out that one of the three disks in this kind of safe's lock, one for each number in the combination, has 12 indents along its edge to confuse safecrackers who try to sense tiny differences in resistance to determine when the disc falls into place. So yeah, so that was it. So when he realized that basically his little robot could find that last number like really fast. You just have to detect it. And so that really knocked down the solution space even more. So the bottom line then was that he could crack this type of safe reliably, like say within an hour. I've heard numbers between 45 minutes and 71 minutes. And that's the longest time it would take for him to crack these safes with his robot. Sometimes it would take 10 minutes. 15 minutes. When he was doing the demonstration at that DEF CON conference, cybersecurity conference, he set the computer, the robot, to working, and he gave a 50-minute speech. And he was like, man, I hope it cracks the safe before the end of my speech. And it cracked it in 30 minutes. So very impressive. So now some people might think, well, what the hell is this jerk doing? Is he trying to help burglars? And you could kind of reasonably say that. When, you know, when somebody does something like this, you're like, this is going to help the bad guys. But the way he sees it, he sees this effort as harmless, do-it-yourself fun. But he said he also sees it as a warning to people who put too much faith into cheap safes. You know, he wants to show, you know, sure, these safes work, but I mean, there are limits to these things. And if you really want to be extra, extra safe, you need to step it up to more commercial grade stuff and maybe to take other steps in place. Also, he also thinks that it's important to demonstrate the changing landscape as cheap robotics become more and more common. And that's true. I mean, whoever thought, I mean, we've seen all movies over the years. I've never really thought of like, hey, what if you make a robot to do this very quickly and very, very accurately? That's just something that people need to recognize in the future. This is going to become more and more common. And he put his plans out onto the internet. So basically it's like open source. So people can take his whole design and tweak it and do whatever they want to it. And who knows, you know, what could come of that, once people start really working on this. And it's true. Right now, this is a special skill. Not many people could have done what these three guys did. I mean, that's not a trivial thing what they did. This is a pretty slick little thing. Although, but in the grand scheme of things, though, it's really not that sophisticated, especially in 2017. You know, somebody was going to do this sooner or later. And, so it's interesting. Well, it's interesting to see where this is going to lead.
That's like the equivalent of ethical hacking in a way.
Well,
they
sure,
kind of expose the vulnerabilities and weaknesses in systems and then report on it so that they can make improvements.
Companies pay good money to have that done.
And they should.
Oh, yeah, what's that called again? Is it like a white hat versus the black hat?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, the hacker community is huge, and there's different kinds of hackers, of course. I mean, they're, and that conference is like, there's a lot of culture around that conference. I mean, I'm sure that some of our listeners even attend that conference. I would always wanted to go, but you hear funny things like you cannot go to that conference with like a standard cell phone. Because
it's over.
That's awesome.
Everyone's got you.
Of course.
Yeah, like you can't walk in there like, wow, this is really cool. Like they will, you know, they will eat you alive.
Yeah.
Better reset your whole phone, get everything off of there.
But the hacker community, I mean, they have a place. They do good. They are out there alerting us of of nefarious attacks and. You know, can provide help and information. I mean, you have people that make discoveries about some of the hacking jobs that are out there or find vulnerabilities and neutralize things that are going on. I think it's fascinating. Really, really cool stuff.
All right. Well, Jay, it's been a few weeks since we've had a Who's That Noisy.
That is correct, Steve. I had to research my own noisy to remind myself where we were, what was going on. And it turns out this last one was pretty cool. So take a listen to this. And I will I'll see if you guys are smart enough to figure it out.
I say, R2.
Kara said that this one familiar. Was adorable.
It is. It sounds like a sweet robot.
All right, so listen to it again, and then you're going to hear the answer to what it is. And then you're going to hear the original clue again, and you'll really appreciate this.
It was a sunny day, and the children were going to the park.
How about
it's
that?
It's so weird how you can hear it. Oh, my gosh.
All right,
our brains are incredible.
Not a new thing. Lots of people have talked about this. This is either three tones that were manipulated to have the sound of human speech, right? But it isn't as information dense as normal human speech. It's suggestive. I also read that they can take a human voice and convert it down into this sine wave, and that's what they call it. This is like a sine wave speech. Convert it down into that, and it is taking information out, and it's simplifying, in a sense, the amount of information that's being passed. Now, the trick of this and the cool thing of this is that what's actually happening is you are loading your brain with how to interpret it. And what I did was I listened to a lot of these, and I got pretty damn good at decoding the sine wave language. Like, isn't that interesting? Like, I was training my brain to interpret that sound better so I can hear the speech. So we had a winner from last week, Andrew Breziel. And Andrew said that was a sine wave speech used by Dr. Matt Davies at MRC, Cognition and Brain Sciences Unit of Cambridge University. Research focuses on perception, particularly the pop-out. And that's the thing. When they say you hear the person speak the regular words, and then you hear the sine wave speech again, you understand what it is. That's the pop-out. So that's when you know what the pattern is being said. But I really wanted to... to give it to one of our listeners named Danny, because he not only nailed it, but he gave such a really wonderful explanation. So he said, to Who's That Noisy? Last week's noisy is an example of sine wave speech as demonstrated by Matt Davies. Basically, it's just a bunch of sine waves, but through the magic, the quote-unquote magic of pareidolia, we perceive a woman saying, it was a sunny day and the children were going to the park. There are more examples, you know, he gives examples or whatever, but I think it's really interesting to think. And of course, I'm sure Kara and Steve are like listening to this freaking out because they can tell us neurologically what's going on. But your brain is almost given like the decoded puzzle answer that your brain can then apply to it the next time you hear it. And then it's almost as if someone is talking normally. You really can hear what the thing is saying. And I do believe that our brains are these amazing puzzle-solving machines that can really take something like this and do instant decoding, right? How quickly is your brain decoding that, Steve, when you hear it the second time?
Yeah, in real time. Obviously, I mean fast. I would never say instant, but you know, very, very fast. So what essentially your brain decides when it hears something if a sound is speech or not speech. And if it's speech, then it tries to decode it. It tries to match the phonemes to phonemes that it recognizes that it has learned, and then to build words out of that. and to match words that it knows, right?
Yep.
That when you're just hearing a bunch of squeaks, your brain isn't necessarily trying to decode it. It's just a bunch of squeaks. But then you hear the phrase, and now your brain has the template. So now it's trying to, now that helps it match it to that. And so your brain interprets it as best it can as speech. So it makes that connection. Now you're slotting it into your speech, you know, recognition software, when before you weren't doing that.
And so your processing speed goes up, like you're primed for it.
And that's the pop out.
Yeah, it's the pop out.
And once the cat's out of the bag, like now that you know that this exists and what it kind of sounds like, even if you heard something, you would start to decode it in a different way the next time you hear this. Let me see if I have another one here. Like really? Listen to this.
The camel was kept in a cage at the zoo.
Okay, that was...
Yeah, the camel's kept in the cage at the zoo.
Yeah, and I believe that was the original speech. One.
Oh. Yeah. I was like, Jay, it's so easy.
Right? That was the original noisy that I played.
But you did it backwards, so we heard it already.
Yeah, you primed us already, so we could hear it.
Yeah, I know, but you already heard it. I'm just saying, though, like, once you get that decoded concept in your subconscious, your brain is just processing it and chugging along and giving you the answer in real time. That is amazing.
I have a client. She's Chinese. There's three of us in our office. Two of us in the office, not me, can't understand a word she's saying. I've learned to detect her patterns in such a way that I can now, when I listen carefully, hear exactly what she's saying, but my coworkers can't figure it out. I wonder if this is kind of a similar sort of thing that I'm training myself.
Absolutely.
To understand really her specifically.
It's repetition. Yeah. You've had so much exposure that you kind of have these templates that you use now.
I've gotten better at understanding patients with dysarthria. We neurologically can't pronounce words.
Yikes.
I mean, sometimes it's unintelligible. That's how you sort of grade how severe it is by how intelligible it is. But still, I've sort of developed an ear for trying to figure out what they're saying, even when it's garbled.
Wow, that's cool. All right, this week's noisy was sent in by a listener named Andrew Crotchmull, and I find this one to be pretty cool. Check this out. Anybody That's like cool. a clue?
That reminds me of War of the Worlds.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah,
ominous sci-fi sound. You know.
Oh yeah,
like
you're right.
Something menacing.
I sense that.
And it had like a scratchy radio kind of component to it too.
Yeah. So if you think you know what this week's noisy is, or man, if you've heard anything cool, I need some help over here because I've been out of the loop for a few weeks now. Send that to me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. All right, Kara, what's the word?
Ooh, the word this week is a fun one because it was recommended by Les Howard from Atlanta, Georgia, who wrote to say, quote, "During the law of robotics discussion, I heard the word recursion used." I'm thinking this might have been when we were at Nexus. I could be wrong.
Yes, that's correct.
Sorry. That was my parenthetical. Okay, yeah. So continuing to say, "But the meaning applied to it didn't align with how I understand the term. I'm trained as a computer scientist, and to me, recursion means a self-referential process, an algorithm that solves a problem by reducing the problem into smaller pieces and calling itself on the smaller pieces." This is a really interesting recommendation, Les. So I thank you for that, because recursion, the noun, or recursive, the adjective, there are a few different but kind of relatable definitions. So in these kinds of situations, what I like to do is to go back to the etymology first. So recursion is actually an earlier form of the word. It comes from the Latin recursionem, which actually breaks down to a running backward or a return. The stem root of that is recurrere, which, you know, as we see in the word recur, has that kind of that root. So this return, this backward, this coming back thing. So later on, about a century and a half later, recursive as an adjective came around, and that more specifically became understood to be periodically recurring, but then the mathematical sense of something being recursive did not come around until its first use in the mid-1900s. So let's talk a little bit about what it is. Like, what is recursion? It is similar to those roots, and there are a couple of different definitions. One of them is specifically a computer programming definition that I think speaks a little bit more to what Les was writing about. But in mathematics and also in linguistics, recursion, or something being recursive, means that it relates to or it involves the repeated application of a rule, definition, or procedure to successive results. That's how Oxford words it. Another way to put it, as Merriam words it, the determination of a succession of elements, such as numbers or functions, by operation on one or more preceding elements according to a rule or formula involving a finite number of steps. A very good example of recursion in the mathematical sense is, what's the word we've done previously? Fractals.
Yeah, baby.
Fractals are recursive. Oh my God, the Fibonacci sequence is recursive. There are many examples of this in mathematics. In computer programming, recursion involves the use of a procedure, a subroutine, a function, or an algorithm that calls itself one or more times until a specified condition is met, at which time the rest of each repetition is processed from the last one called to the first. It's different than something iterating. Let's see if Oxford's definition is a little clearer. Actually, I think Les's computer definition was the clearest. But Oxford says, relating to or involving a program or routine of which a part requires the application of the whole, so that its explicit interpretation requires, in general, many successive executions. And again, Les said that he understands it as a computer scientist to be a self-referential process, an algorithm that solves a problem by reducing the problem into smaller pieces and calling itself on the smaller pieces. So then, Les, you were confused by our use of recursive in the conversation about robotics, because we probably implied but didn't explicitly say that we were talking about this idea of recursive self-improvement, which is this AI fantasy. We're not there yet, but this AI question that could potentially lead or not lead, this is really where the debate came in, to a singularity type situation where an artificial intelligence can actually improve its own self-improvements. It is recursive in that every time it fixes something or betters itself, it learns from that and then reapplies it and reapplies it and reapplies it. And this is maybe I shouldn't say theory, but a hypothesis that a lot of these kind of futurists will discuss in detail, that could lead to what they sometimes call the AI takeoff, the intelligence explosion, or again, maybe even the technological singularity. So we were saying that, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, that artificial intelligence does not have to be cognitive, or it doesn't have to be conscious. It simply has to be recursive for us to get to that place that we were predicting or not predicting based on the argument.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could almost think of it as any process that builds on itself.
Yeah, but of course, there is a subtle but I think important distinction there between the use in math and the use in computer science. And I could see why what we were saying could have been confusing. But of course, they are all based on that same deep root that really comes down to this idea of returning, of coming back to, of reverting. Which makes sense.
Yeah. Yep. Cool. That's a good word.
Very cool word.
Jay, before we go to an email, we have a couple of announcements to make. Why don't you start us off?
So you guys know about the QED conference, right? That is in England, correct?
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. I got to go last year. It was so much fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Steve, you went.
Yeah, I was there a few years ago. Yeah.
It's so in Manchester.
That is correct. It's a two-day science and skepticism convention that's taking place at the Mercure Piccadilly Hotel in Manchester from the 14th to the 15th of October 2017. So we have something pretty cool to announce. For SGU listeners, two entry prize tickets will be awarded. This includes a QED conference, including the Saturday night gala dinner.
No way. Mm. I assume we're not allowed to enter, right? It's no, just the listeners.
Oh. We cannot.
So,
maybe you can quit and enter.
Here's what you got to do if you want to go, right? So if you want to actually try to enter the contest, first, you have to be able to go. right? You have to be able to physically. Yes. You have to physically be able to make it to Manchester for the weekend of October 14th and 15th, and also you have to answer the following question:
what is your favorite color? Oh, sorry.
Which two rogues have previously appeared at QED? Now, if you were paying attention, you may have picked up on some not so subtle cues on which two rogues have been to QED, right, in the past. And then you take those your deductive powers and you write an email to sgu@qedcon.org. That's sgu@qedcon.org. And, you know, make sure your name is in there. And then answer the question, which two rogues have previously appeared at QED? And hopefully you'll win. And we will be announcing this again on the show. We'll be reminding you. And then in a couple of shows from now, we will be announcing the winners. Yeah.
So we should mention that there are two other conferences this year that at which the SGU will appear. The first one is Dragon Con.
Yeah.
If you've never been, Dragon Con is a lot of fun. It's basically Nerdvana. This will be September 1st through September 4th in Atlanta, Georgia. We have our live show from the stage. We do a private show. We'll be on a lot of panels. It's a ton, if you've never been, ton of fun. If you have been, you understand. Okay, and then we're going to be at SciCon in Las Vegas, October 26th through 29th. I'll be giving a talk there, and the SGU, again, all of us will be there to perform on stage. So that'll be a lot of fun as well. George Trav will be there. He's the MC. They've got a great lineup as well. Just go to SciConference.org, and you can see the list of all the speakers they have there. Really exciting. All right. One quick email. Not going to read an actual email. We got about 1,000 emails correcting us on the sound barrier.
Oh, boy.
Jay's going to talk a little bit about some of the Concorde people. So we were talking about supersonic flight and the physics of the sonic boom came up. Hadn't really prepped it, so we were just speaking off the cuff. The question was, is the sonic boom, does that happen only when an object breaks the sound barrier, or is it a continuous phenomenon when you're moving faster than sound? I thought it was the former when in fact it's the latter, which is interesting because it's never really presented that way. But now, of course, I've had an opportunity to do a deep dive on exactly what causes the sonic boom, and it makes perfect sense. The best explanation I read of all the different ones that I read, think about this analogy. Think of a boat drifting on a lake, for example.
All right.
Right. So there'll be concentric waves coming out from the boat as it disturbs the water. And if the boat moves slowly through the water, then it'll still be sending out those waves, but it'll be sort of catching up to the waves in front of it and leaving farther gaps in the waves behind it. What happens when the boat is going faster than the speed of water, of waves moving through the surface of the water? Well, then all of the waves in front of the boat essentially pile up on top of each other and you get one big wave. And that is the wake of the boat. Right. So that's basically what the wake is. So now you can visualize a boat moving through the water at faster than the speed of waves through the surface of the water, creating a big wake, which then travels out in a cone behind it. That's exactly what happens when objects travel faster than the speed of sound. They compress the sound waves in front of them because they're basically catching up to the sound waves as they're leaving. Mm-hmm. And then when they're going faster than the speed of sound through air and wherever they are, which is variable based on local conditions, but whatever, then the waves pile up in front of the plane. They can't get out of the way in time. And then that creates this cone like the two-dimensional wake of a ship, but you have a three-dimensional cone in the air with the tip at the point of the plane and then going back behind it. And that's essentially a massive sound wave. And that's what you hear as the boom. When that wake or that sonic wave passes you, you hear a boom. Some planes are large enough that they actually can create, or just based upon their design, they might actually have two wave fronts. And so you might hear a double boom. But
oh, that's cool.
Yeah, but those that just like the wake of a ship hitting the shore, you know, that sonic wave is made the entire time a plane is traveling faster than the speed of sound. So it's basically leaving a sonic boom in its wake as it travels through the air. And so if a plane traveling at supersonic speeds would leave a sonic boom on its entire pathway over which it was traveling faster than the speed of sound.
I see. So any stationary position along that path, as long as it's breaking the sound barrier, you're going to hear the boom.
Yeah, but and you'll hear the boom after it passes you by because it's obviously going faster than the sound wave. So there'll be a delay for the sound to hit you. And it's very, very loud, of course, which is why you'd have to travel very at extreme altitude to try to, because it is, the inverse square law still applies. So you want to be farther away. And that's, of course, why NASA is working on designs that would minimize the sonic boom. And if they can get the sound low enough, they're hoping that it won't be necessary essentially to ban supersonic overland flight. Could you imagine if there were planes leaving trails of sonic boom all over the place, all over the country?
That makes a lot of sense.
Mildly disruptive, yeah.
Because I for some reason thought the sonic boom only happened at the breaking point, at that tipping point into the speed of sound. But it does make perfect sense now that I hear you say that, and I've read up on this, that it's just if you're breaking the sound barrier, you're creating a continuous sonic boom. A couple of things, one person wrote in and gave some cool details about the Concorde and about sonic booms. He was saying that for every 1,000 feet the plane is off the ground, it's a mile wide cone of sound that you can hear. So if the plane is flying at 60,000 feet, that cone of sound, it could be huge, but of course the volume would be lower if it was that high. But still, showing you that it's hitting a lot of people. It would affect a ton of people if supersonic jets were flying over population, areas that were densely populated. It could be hugely disruptive. Another interesting thing that I read was that the Concorde stopped flying because the manufacturers stopped supporting, I guess, the aircraft, and it wasn't a financial problem.
Yeah,
Yeah, I've heard several different things about why the Concorde stopped flying, and it's probably one of those things where it may be hard to say it was this one thing. The fact that it wasn't making money, that was a fact.
Yeah, economics usually wins the day.
Yeah, it's hard to say that played no role in them stopping to flying it. But yeah, it's just the whole thing. There was an accident. It wasn't really the fault of the Concorde, but that had a negative PR impact on it. And the people say that's why they canceled it. That's not why they canceled it, but I'm sure it didn't help. It wasn't making money, and they just did the airline, and nobody wanted to continue to support it because it wasn't profitable.
The other thing I read was that when you're on the plane, you don't hear the sonic boom.
Oh, yeah, of course, because you're traveling faster than it.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I read that
just behind you.
I read that it had a lot to do also with the speed of sound that would travel through the fuselage as opposed to the speed of sound in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like a differential there that would have an effect on what you were hearing aboard. Okay. And another cool thing, a lot of people that wrote in, that had the opportunity to fly on the Concorde were saying that, just how awesome it was inside. Like they had like the speed of the plane in the everyone could see exactly how fast the plane is going. And then, one person wrote it and said that the engines were more efficient the faster they went.
That can generally be true of jet engines, because you think about it, jet engines have to compress air. And when you're traveling very quickly through the air, your speed is compressing the air for you. So it does make the jet engines, depending on their design, that they have an optimal running speed. But yeah, they could get more efficient as they go faster because the air compression is being taken care of.
And some types of jet engines, I think, actually depend on that. Like, I think like when you get to scramjets and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to be going at a certain minimum velocity before they start to work. Yeah. All right, guys. Well, let's go on to science fiction now.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Are you guys ready for this week?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
All right. three interesting items this week. Here we go. Number one, scientists report that they have successfully used CRISPR to fix a disease-causing gene mutation in a newly fertilized egg, effectively curing the disease and preventing its further inheritance. Item number two, researchers have demonstrated that by analyzing millions of tweets, they can predict the perpetrators of specific crimes. And item number three, a new genetic analysis finds that scorpions and spiders share a common ancestor. Now, I just wanted to clarify that rather than just getting all technical. That means that scorpions and spiders are more closely related to each other than either is to any other group, right? Kara, go first.
Okay. Scientists report they have successfully used CRISPR to fix a disease-causing gene mutation in a newly fertilized egg, effectively curing the disease and preventing its further inheritance. Ooh, that's a compound. Effectively curing it and preventing its further inheritance. Oh, of course, because using CRISPR, they're actually going into the genome and editing it so that that mutation would not be passed down. Or is it transient? Okay. Researchers have demonstrated that by analyzing millions of tweets, that's easy enough, they can predict the perpetrators of specific crimes. There's just like no context in this clue at all. It's like the most vague thing ever. Like, sure, I could see that happening. What crimes? I mean, maybe cybercrime. That would be interesting. Or, you know, we sometimes see that like dumb criminals will like hold up a convenience store and then like take a selfie with their gun and their bag of money and then tweet it. So I could see that happening. And then this has happened like recently on Facebook. They've been able to actually catch some people on Facebook. Okay. A new genetic analysis finds that scorpions and spiders share a common ancestor. Well, these arthropods, these arachnids, I thought scorpions were arachnids. This one seems like too likely to be unlikely, which means it'll probably be the fiction. Damn it, Steve. Okay. All of these seem reasonable to me. The CRISPR one is the fiction. There's got to be some specific problem in here that maybe they were able to fix the gene only transiently and not actually affect its how hereditary it is. I don't know. I don't think I'm using that word right, but whether or not it could be passed down. So, shit. I'm going to say CRISPR was the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
I'm going to say CRISPR is not the fiction.
Damn it.
Don't get too cocky.
Don't get cocky, kid.
Don't get too uncocky, I guess it's okay. Better. Because, I mean, they don't mention humans here at all, so I could see them totally doing this on, like, a frog or whatever. So, yeah, I could see that. I think we're at the point where we could do that. And what about all those ancillary genome updates, though, that was all scary a little while ago. I wonder what the status of that is. So I'll say that one's science. And the scorpion and spider, yeah, I mean, they're both arachnids. So what? The spiders and scorpions are closer than spiders and ticks and mites and other arachnids? Yeah, whatever. So I'll say that one's science, too, which means that the tweet one is fiction. I guess that one could be fiction. So the other ones seem less likely to be fiction, so I'm going to say that the tweet is fiction.
Okay, Jay.
This one about CRISPR being able to fix a disease-causing gene in a newly fertilized egg. That the part that I don't like here is the newly fertilized egg part, because I mean I read about CRISPR quite a bit, and I've never quite heard anything said about like them being able to do it in something that isn't that developed. This one about analyzing the tweets. I think that with enough data, sure, you could have some predictions about people that might be about to commit crimes. I mean, it just depends. I mean, I don't use Twitter that much, but it's more of just a data set. If you just think about it, you can analyze kind of any social media and see is there anything that's happening in the verbiage that they're using or whatever that could be shedding a light on the person's mental state and, you know, maybe predicting some behaviors. I don't know. Interesting. I wouldn't put it past software to be able to do something crazy like that. And then this last one, scorpions and spiders share a common ancestor. My gut reaction to it was that the two animals don't remind me much of each other, even though they both kind of scuttle. But I can kind of see, yeah, all right, sure. I mean, you know, everything has to branch back to something, and I don't have any real reason to think why that these two creatures wouldn't have some type of common ancestor. So out of the gate, my gut was telling me that I don't like the CRISPR one, so I'm going to say that's the fiction.
Okay, and Evan?
Well, I think the CRISPR one is going to be science. We've talked before on the show about how CRISPR technology and advancements are racing along at, you know, relatively lightning pace. And this would be just another, I think, advancement in heading in that direction. I think Bob brings up a good point, too. We're not necessarily talking about humans. So I think this one's going to be right. I think the one about tweets, though, is going to turn out to be the fiction. Two couple things here. Analyzing millions of tweets. Obviously, they're not analyzing any one individual. They're collecting tons of them from all sorts of people. And then predicting the perpetrators of specific crimes? No, I don't think so. Not specific crimes. You may be able to get some generalities out of certain things and see some general patterns. I don't think specific crimes, though. Too narrow. So I think that one's wrong. That one's fiction. And that, you know, obviously scorpions and spiders, common ancestor. Sure. Why not? So tweets, fiction.
Okay, so we're split 2-2, which means you all agree with the third one. So we'll start there. A new genetic analysis finds that scorpions and spiders share a common ancestor, by which I mean that they are more closely related to each other than anything else. You all think this one is science. Let me ask you a question. What do you guys think about ticks?
They carry disease.
Yeah.
They're hard to kill.
Also arachnids.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that too.
Superficially more similar, I think, than to spiders and scorpions, I guess, but
there's also an order of arachnids called pseudoscorpions.
Hmm. Oh, really?
Yeah, but scorpions and spiders do share a common ancestor.
Yay!
Yeah, so that was your reaction was funny, Kara, because that's exactly what I was going for. It's like it's so simple that somebody mm-hmm. might think it's a ringer, you know.
Ha ha, you bastard.
You always get me with those, too.
But it's mostly I wanted to talk about it because the actual underlying science was cool. And so it's not so much that they're closely related. That's not that exciting. I mean, yeah, they're both arachnids. You know, we know that they're pretty close. The fact that they're closest, okay. Nothing surprising there. But what they did a whole genome, you know, wide analysis, which, you know, of course, is getting a lot easier and cheaper to do. And what they found was that both scorpions and spiders share a common event in their genetic past. And Ooh. That is a rare event called a whole genome duplication. At some point, which is pretty self-explanatory.
That's a thing.
At some point, the entire genome was duplicated in their common ancestor. Now, when that does happen, most of the extra copies do then get lost over time, so you don't necessarily permanently double your genome. But what it does do is it gives an extra redundant copy of pretty much of every gene, right?
Think about the genetic drift, and you could just totally exactly. play with stuff. Damn.
Exactly. That's exactly what evolutionary biologists think. In fact, there was a whole genome duplication event at the base of the vertebrate clade. And the question is, how important are such events for later evolution? Because you have all these redundant genes that you could then play with.
It's got to be huge.
It's
more
huge.
More importantly, in my eyes, how the f*** does that happen?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, just at some point, you know, all it took was one organism that it had an error in reproduction and survived, you know, basically with a double genome.
That's what I mean. How do you get a double genome? It's like, you know, what's the mechanism behind doubling your genome?
Yeah, well, your genes always divide. Like, your DNA divides a lot. So I could see that being some sort of just like...
Yeah, that doesn't
It's not true. Uncommon.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's evolutionarily speaking, it's uncommon, apparently. But
yeah, it's probably uncommon, but I could see, I don't know, it doesn't seem that crazy, I guess.
Yeah, right. It doesn't seem that crazy to me either. So that's exactly the kind of mistakes that are made when you're copying the genome. But like there are whole chromosome duplications, there are chromosome fusions, and all these sorts of things happen over evolutionary history.
One of my best friends has an extra piece of a chromosome floating around. She's like a brilliant Caltech scientist and beautiful and like won the genetic lottery in so many ways, but she's got an extra chunk of one of her chromosomes.
Yeah.
Like did not affect her at all. She's just kind of floating around in her cells. Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
And if she became the founder of a new population, then she, yeah, maybe that would be the normal for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
An extra chromosome. Okay. What they do find though is that when they look at the genes of spiders and arachnids, similar to, again, like analyzing vertebrates, is that after that, this whole genome duplication event, that there are clusters of types of genes that survive and take on new functions. And so it did have an incredible effect on later evolution and allows for a lot more experimentation, a lot more variability. You now just have all this raw material that you could play with. So it does sort of put the afterburners on evolution for a while. And they think that maybe this might be responsible for why the vertebrate, you know, clade, why vertebrates have been so successful as an evolutionary group, because right at the base there we had this whole genome duplication. Gave us a lot of genetic raw material to work with.
Yeah, now that I think of it, I would think that that kind of genetic duplication would be more common than I think it might be, because it's just so damn beneficial.
Well, when it does happen, it's beneficial, but it still may be a rare event when it does happen. But anyway, this type of whole genome analysis is now becoming rapid and cheap, and so we're just at the very beginning of this kind of analysis. Spiders and scorpions, okay, but you know they're going to be able to do this with all different types of groups, and we'll be learning lots of fascinating stuff. Okay, let's go back. I guess we'll just work in reverse order. Researchers have demonstrated that by analyzing millions of tweets, they can predict the perpetrators of specific crimes. Bob and Evan, you think this one is the fiction. Jay and Kara, you think this one is science. And this one is fiction.
Yeah.
Damn it. Damn it.
Evan, you came the closest in your analysis. This was a study looking at Twitter for crime prediction, but they were just predicting very generally just crime tendencies. Yeah. So like types of crimes, like what types of crimes are going to be occur, not like like this guy over here is going to commit a crime tomorrow. Yeah, not specific. That's more, this was inspired by person of interest, but we're not quite there yet.
The key word in this one that absolutely got me was predict. I didn't even think of, like when I read it, I just thought like that they could find them. I don't know. It did not translate to me.
Yeah, you were thinking about, you missed the whole predict part.
I missed the whole point. Yeah, that obviously this is predictive policing, but with Twitter as a tool.
So I think it will be useful. I think social media will be useful, is turning out to be useful for predictive policing. And this is one more, you know, piece to that puzzle, but we're not at the point of being able, like with a person of interest or Minority Report, you know, like this guy's, you know, like they were psychic, pre-crime, of course, but like, yeah, this guy's going to kill this person tomorrow at noon. You know, we're not there yet, but it wouldn't surprise me if at some point we get to that point. We're obviously never going to predict things with 100%, but where it's like, yeah, these people are conspiring to commit a crime because of their activity on social media, or, you know, even if you're trying to hide it, you might give yourself away in so many subtle ways that a computer would be able to see.
Oh, right. Absolutely.
Like the way I think I mentioned in a recent episode where somebody came up with an algorithm for predicting when somebody was pregnant based on kind of innocuous purchases. It's a very similar, very, very similar idea. Exactly.
All right. All this means that scientists report that they have successfully used CRISPR to fix a disease causing gene mutation in a newly fertilized egg, effectively curing the disease and preventing its further inheritance is science. And I forgot to include in there because I just assumed that it was implied was that this was a human egg. This was human.
Yeah, I figured you wouldn't even include, like, this was so trending everywhere. I figured everybody read it. But it's one of those things where you read it like the headline.
Glanced it.
You know what I mean? Yeah, exactly.
Wow, so it was a human. Jeez.
Yeah, I actually pitched this story to Steve in my list of stories for the week.
Oh, gosh. Which you don't share with the rest of us. Thank you very much.
But I do that a lot.
I didn't read it in detail.
I changed the details to make it the fiction. So it's, unless you read the whole thing carefully.
Mm-hmm.
So,
why would I do that if I wasn't actually presenting it? I know.
Yeah. So anyway. This is cool. This is very encouraging. And yes, this is exactly what we're working on. Yes, this is the next sort of step. But this is, you know, we've had some discouraging news recently, which although was very controversial about unintended mutations from CRISPR. Again, CRISPR is a tool, very powerful tool for causing specific changes to a DNA. You know, essentially they took it from a bacteria. Yeah, bacteria were using this. We basically stole that machinery from them and said, yep, we're going to use this to do genetic modification. So this is the holy grail, right? This is exactly what we want to use it for. So this would be used for, this was just a research, but you could use this technique for in vitro fertilization, right? You fertilize the eggs in the petri dish, and then before you implant it in the woman, you use CRISPR to fix some horrible genetic disease.
And make them smarter and a little taller. And a
well,
little
that now, you, now you're taking three steps. going 3 steps forward. But the specific disease that they successfully edited, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, it's a common cause of sudden death in otherwise healthy young athletes. So 1 in 500 people are affected. And Kara, this would prevent it from being passed on by that person because this would affect the germline as well.
That's
as
it. Absolutely. So the germline. Yeah.
You get it early enough, it affects all cells.
Which is obvious, like when you think about it, but I thought there must be some sort of trick in this one where it was like a transient change and then it comes back or something.
Now, good, even better news, they analyzed the resulting eggs and they found that they didn't have unintended mutations, that they were healthy, they were genetically healthy, their Whoa, chromosomes were
that's
good.
That's great news.
And they didn't have unintended mutations. Nice. So
when did they get clearance to implant them?
Yeah, I don't know.
That's what I want to know.
Come on.
That would be the next step.
Fast track.
But this looks very, very good. This is very, very encouraging.
CRISPR races along. Yep.
Yeah, this is what we want to use it for, right? We want to cure genetic diseases. Of course, you have to go through IVF. You know, you can't do this, you know, the natural way. But still, I mean, if there are people who know that they're carrying genes for horrible diseases but still might want to have their own kids, well, there you go. We'll just edit out those horrible diseases and you're good to go.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
I'm all for it.
Yeah.
Who could be against
that? Yeah, that is really cool. Yeah, I mean, somebody who knows
Super
that,
kids.
You know, they could be carrying Huntington, somebody who, you know, there's a risk of Tay-Sachs. Like, I mean, it's just incredible.
Yeah.
It's very
like
cool.
That. Horrible.
Yeah. Oh, the Tay-Sachs one is, ugh.
Exactly. Yeah. If we could figure out how to edit it out in everybody who has children, it would be done. Yeah. Like,
no,
this is the coolest
thing. It wouldn't be
done. Oh, this one wouldn't. It's not like Huntington's. You're right. It's
No. Here's the thing. We will never rid ourselves of genetic diseases because all genetic diseases have a spontaneous mutation rate. And so what you will do is
we'll have to keep up with it.
You'll minimize it down to the spontaneous mutation rate. But there are like Tay-Sachs, for example, is when there's also a population where Huntington's disease is very common. There are populations. It's called the founder effect. If you have a group of people who basically are the descendants of one small population, then a genetic disease that was in one of the founders of that small population now is very common in the broader population. So like Ashkenazi Jews have like certain diseases that are endemic in their population because of that small, just they just happen to be descended from somebody who had it. For
but
example,
it doesn't matter.
So you'd be able to get rid of those. Well, it does if you have a somatic mutation after the egg's fertilized. And so that, you know what I mean? So then you'd have to basically be curing people after you know they have the disease rather than editing it out in the embryo stage before they even develop.
I see.
That's just a different procedure.
So
but
you still
theoretically
need the egg.
Possible. Theoretically possible. But imagine now you're doing it to a person rather than doing it to a clump of cells.
I'm down for that. I mean,
yeah, but it's but it,
yeah,
but
I'll
that,
take it.
That's a different kettle of fish. It's a different kettle of fish. Yeah, absolutely harder to do. So we'd like to just edit it out in the embryonic stage. And some mutations may be there at that point too. But again, if it's a new mutation, how do you know? You know, this way
we know
because the parents have it.
Yeah, if we can take it, I mean, we can do the genotype, right? Like if you can do it early enough and you can take the actual genotype and run it through the database and you can find the certain SNPs that are like detrimental, like I would love it. Again, I don't know much about my genetic history except what I learn on, or not history, but whatever, except what I learn on 23andMe, but I know that I have a slightly elevated risk of certain things. Why not just nip those out? Mm-hmm. I'd be down. I'd be down to not have any risk of early onset or late onset.
With no risk of
Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. Yeah. I mean, that's always going to be there. The risk of mutation is going to be there. But if you have something that's not deterministic but probabilistic, obviously, why not clean that up?
No, it'd be fascinating. It's amazing. You know, so let's say 90% of the human genome is junk. That's probably a good, you know, a good estimate. It's at least 75%. It could be as much as 95%. So let's say it's 90%. Mm-hmm. What if we genetically engineered a population of people who had only the 10% of the genome they need and they didn't have
I don't know. I just still feel like there's something in all of that.
Junk.
Those, what are they, exons? Yeah. There's something in that that even though we don't know what it's for, I would be interested to see what would happen if we just nixed it all.
The lattice
of life.
That would be
an interesting experiment. It would prove that it is junk if you really, really don't need it. But we know, I mean, what we can say is that at least 75% of the genome is not conserved at all, meaning they can mutate away without losing any function, which could mean they don't have any function. That's the simplest explanation. So the most parsimonious explanation.
Yeah, but the genes are actually still there.
Yeah, the genes are there. Yeah, so 5% of the genome is genes. Maybe another 5-10% is regulatory or has some other kind of structural role that's not transcribed.
Yeah, like what happens if you take it all out? Like, are our genes going to like fall out? Like, is something terrible going to happen? Yeah, you might need that support. Yeah.
We'll figure it out. Maybe what if we only had like 2 chromosomes? You don't need 23 chromosomes. You just need 2 to hold all the genes.
Well, what the hell?
To get rid of all the junk.
I know, right?
We would be lean and mean.
Yeah.
It's like what a terribly inefficient system.
We live longer. Oh, my gosh. Would our cells be reproduce easier? I mean,
less chance of disease?
We're dragging around all this DNA junk and reproducing it and replicating it. And it's just folding it up and everything. We're dealing with all this baggage.
You're legit calling for a defrag of our chromosomes.
Yeah, we need to defrag our
chromosomes. I love
that. not just defrag, just redesign from the bottom up.
Yeah, like almost like building a computer from scratch. Hey, we came full circle.
Yeah, look at that.
All right, Evan, give us a quote and get us out of here.
All right, this one was submitted by listener Jerry from London, Jerry Bandrith. Thank you very much, Jerry. If someone is able to show me that what I think or do is not right, I will happily change, for I seek the truth by which no one was ever truly harmed. It is the person who continues in his self-deception and ignorance who is harmed. That is from the writings of Marcus Aurelius. Yes.
Yeah, Marcus Aurelius was a critical thinker. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Absolutely. His Meditations, significant source of the modern understanding of ancient Stoic philosophy, considered by many commentators to be one of the greatest works of philosophy. A real philosopher and a politician. Yes, and an awesome name.
Marcus Aurelius.
Marcus Aurelius. Where are you today, Marcus Aurelius? We need you.
I know, it's
badly.
It's so Shakespearean, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's cool.
It's great.
Well, thank you, Evan.
Thank you, Steve.
And thank you all for joining me this week.
You got it.
Sure, all
right. See you next week.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.